everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Renowned Podcast. We are your co-creators and co-hosts for the show, Mark Schultz and...
And Allison Hager.
Allison, hi, how are you?
Great. How have you been? We've had a little hiatus. It's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, you too. Do you want to jump in and remind everyone what our noun of this episode is?
Yes, our compound noun for this episode is the American Harvest Mouse, which is a little bit of a departure for us based on Mark's fantastic new noun generator, which is up on the website if anyone wants to go look at it. So this was a little fun, I think. It was a little different than what we're used to with our one word nouns.
Yeah, that was generally broader or like a concept or something. So yeah, I totally agree with you. This was a different way to go. Oh, cool. Well, shall we roll?
Let's roll.
Three, dead in the middle.
Three. So roll again.
Die. This happens a lot. We tie and then I get a six.
I got a six too.
Oh, hey. When do we go to jail?
Okay.
Just kidding. That's the three of doubles. Four.
Four.
What?
Okay, we said it at the same time, so you know I'm not even messing with you.
That I'm gonna run the probability of that because it's pretty high or low.
Pretty low.
What am I trying to say? Low.
Yeah. One. And at the same time, five.
Oh, okay. All right.
Wow, this is like a new one for me this year. Though.
I know.
That was amazing. I feel like we should play those numbers in lottery. I mean, I think lotteries are a waste of money, but honestly, with that, right, we should probably do 164 or 364.
Excellent. All right. So we'll put 15 seconds on the clock for your just the hits as we jump in here. All right. 15 seconds to tell me about the American Harvest Mouse and go.
This is about to be a very wealthy mouse. Who said this? Why did they say this? And what does it matter? That's what we'll be exploring today.
Nice. 4 seconds left. Oh, interesting.
All right. Are you ready?
Okay.
Did you forget for a second that you had to go?
I'm like, oh, right. I have to go. Okay. I am ready.
All right. And go.
Even the smallest and humblest of mammals can leave a significant footprint in the course of human knowledge and our preparation for the future.
6 seconds left. I love that. The tiniest of mammals.
Right? Like Hugh Galadriel. Even the smallest can change the course of whatever she says. Hugh, Kate Blanchett.
I'm watching Tar great. Right now, interestingly. Brought up Kate Blanchett. Very different role than Galadriel.
I don't know that okay. I've seen it. Anyway, yeah.
I'm only halfway through, but I do highly recommend it. Okay, down the mouse hole we go. Yes. So, Mark, I'm praying that as normal, you did the
sure
etymology.
Did.
Okay, excellent. Because I found so many different like theories on it, and it just got confusing. So I thought, you know what? I'll leave it out because Mark will do it, and he'll do it way better. Okay, so we're going to just jump right into talking about the American Harvest Mouse. So there are two broad types of harvest mice. There's the Old World and the New World, but our noun was specifically American Harvest Mouse. So that's referring to the New World. And the genus is Rhythrodontomus, which means grooved teeth. And it comprises about 22 different species, but we only have about an hour in total. So I'm just going to talk about one of these species, and that is the salt marsh harvest mouse, which is Rhythrodontomus raviventris. All right. So these are, as Mark already commented, these are tiny, adorable animals. And I will post up on our website some of the cutest pictures you've ever seen of little tiny harvest mice sleeping inside of flowers because they climb in to eat the pollen. Okay.
Right. We've probably all seen that. There's like memes on Instagram and stuff about it. Now we can actually post it.
And now I know it says specifically a harvest mouse. Like I never knew that. So they weigh less than an ounce. They're usually between like 2 and 2.8 inches long. And less than an inch tall. So this is how like absolutely itty bitty these adorable little critters are. Their tails, however, are generally 120% the length of their bodies. So they have these incredibly long tails, and not just salt marsh harvest mouse, but all harvest mice have prehensile tails. So that means they can use their tails like a limb. And this is important. There are only a few mammals that have a prehensile tail. And this is the only mouse genus that has it, the harvest mouse. So it's really good for climbing long stalks of grain, thus where they probably got their name. In our case, talking about the salt marsh harvest mice, they can climb the really tall, long marsh grasses. So we're just going to call them salties for short, because it just gets really exhausting saying the very long compound noun. So salties, they can eat very salty food, and they can actually drink seawater. They can swim for more than 2 hours straight. They are the only mammal in the world that lives exclusively in marshes near oceans. So it's just incredible to be like, Mark, kind of what you were saying when we first created this podcast, this idea of like any random noun could open up knowledge for you that you just had no idea or make connections. And for me, just like, wow, this is a pretty unique creature. We tend to think of mice all just lumped together as like mice. These guys are incredible.
They're drinking salt water. So line them up for our sci-fi future where we need humans to be able to drink salt water.
Or they just take over, which I think they deserve, because they weren't discovered until 1908. And just 60 years after that, they were already endangered. They were added to both the federal and California lists of endangered species. They live only in the San Francisco Bay Estuary. It's the only place in the entire world they live, which is a much diminished area of marshland. In fact, between the time they were discovered and now, between 75 to 90% of their habitat has been destroyed by human development. With sea levels now rising, that's not helping. It's compounding the problem. So these little guys are in pretty dire straits. The preservation of the salt marsh harvest mouse habitat was actually a subject of discussion in the 2009 economic stimulus package. So the mouse was mentioned numerous times in Congress by Republicans such as Mike Pence and Dan Lundgren to highlight the wasteful spending of the bill. So, of course, as I think we all know, most of the Republicans were very against this bill. And so they actually used the salties as an example of how ridiculous the Democrats were being. And they claimed that $30 million of the economic stimulus package being proposed would be spent on habitat restoration to protect the mouse. The rumor was apparently started by Mike Steele, who's the press secretary for John Boehner. So this was the Salty's 15 minutes of fame. And that was where my quote came from. Like one of them said, like,
P.S. I'm like, that's a drop in the bucket.
Right.
Anyway. So, oh, I'm sorry. We don't even want to spend that to save a species. Whatever.
Right. And I will talk about why. But so it was a huge lie. It was
right. Not only a lie, but also even lying. It doesn't make sense.
And it doesn't make sense. Right.
Bullshit argument.
So a Republican staffer like trying to defend the statement claims that someone at an unnamed agency, he couldn't even like point to what agency, said to him or to his, you know, representative that $30 million might go to federal wetlands restoration.
Right. Which has a lot of species.
Exactly. A lot of species and a lot of other impacts.
Wetlands are like one of the most critical. I think we also talked about wetlands in our episode around CO2.
Was it highway? It was highway maybe.
Yeah, because, like the fact that how you handle the carbon dioxide like cycle and so on. You need wetlands. They're one of the most important. Anyway.
So they took that and turned it into this outright lie to just make the package sound really like stupid and wasteful. And the San Francisco Bay Area, of course, the wetlands are home to lots of endangered species, but with our salties there, I guess these Republican congressmen just like naturally concluded that quote. The bottom line is, if this bill becomes law, taxpayers will spend $30 million on a mouse. So does anyone really want his or her representative, regardless of your political leanings, do you really want your representative like wasting time and money debating something they know isn't true? I mean, it's so angering to me, like the waste of time, right? That this created. Anyway, John Carter said the bill contained a $30 million earmark for a mouse in California. There are just so many examples. So I'll stop, but I will post in the references some of the articles I read and just all the ridiculous things. It was Tom McClintock of California who said this is about to be a very wealthy little mouse. Okay. So that $30 million actually came from, as I mentioned.
I'm still fuming at it. I'm still fuming.
I knew it was going to get you. Like, I knew it was going to get
you. We're going to be sitting on a husk of a planet with like everything burned out and it's just dust and dirt. And yet they're still going to be like $30 million for dirt, for dust. Why are you fixing that? Well,
also the salties are going to be like, well, see you suckers, because we can drink salt water.
For real. Give us a couple million years. We'll be the dominant species.
So after some digging, it actually turns out that $30 million figure for wetlands restoration came from the California Coastal Conservancy. It's a state agency. And they recommended to numerous federal agencies who were looking for lists of what they call shovel-ready projects, meaning, okay, if we do get some money, where is the biggest need? And the California Coastal Conservancy said, we are ready to go with this. The planning's been done. All the engineering assessments have been done. So this became part of the stimulus bill. The projects actually range from like Napa County to Silicon Valley in California. They involve moving levees, creating islands, converting salt ponds that are industrial back to marshes. It would benefit dozens of species. It would, of course, the salties, but also salmon and steelhead trout and ducks and egrets. So this really, really broad. And the work would also provide increased flood protection to homes and businesses around the San Francisco Bay, which helps humans. So if you are someone who says, I don't care about the animals, well, guess what? With rising sea levels, flooding is becoming a huge problem in all the coastal areas in this country, around the world. And this would really help that.
Plus, as we talked about, all the vegetation, all the CO2 recycling, like the whole system.
Exactly. There's so many levels of benefit here for humans and animals. In fact, in 2003, so about 20 years ago, the Bush administration endorsed and helped fund the largest of these projects. Right. So now that it's become such a divided issue is really, really frustrating. So
identity politics. It's not even a divided issue. They just won't even think about it because
they won't even think about it. Right. Where back in the day, there was some more thoughtful consideration of it between the parties. So the head of the California Coastal Conservancy, actually, he has a quote that says, this isn't school kids planting little sprigs of plants. We are talking about thousands of acres, building levees and islands with heavy equipment. And it's at least 100 new jobs. Just layering on some more info there. But okay, let's go back to our salties. So why should we care that they're endangered? Why should we think that it's important to put this money in? Why should we care about them or any endangered species? Well, according to the International Union for Conservation of Nature's Red List of Threatened Species, which we will link on the website, there are over 26,000 species in danger of extinction right now. That is just, I knew it was a lot, but to me, that is an incredibly daunting number. This includes 40% of amphibians, 34% of conifers, 33% of our reef building corals, 25% of mammals, and 14% of birds. In the US, over 1,600 species are listed as threatened or endangered. So this is a really big deal. And because, as we've discussed before on different episodes of this podcast, every species is connected to myriad other species, right? We all learn in earth science in just, middle school about the food chain.
Absolutely. I was like going to start singing Circle of Life in this piece. Yeah.
Right. I'll hold my cat up and you can sing.
Well done. Yeah.
So I'm curious
if that list takes into account, and I would assume it doesn't, which makes it more shocking, right? That you have that many, but then you only have probably, one step removed from that, those that would rely on them.
They don't include. Yeah, right. Exactly.
So it would just be dominoes, house of cards, whatever you want to call it.
Absolutely. So our salties are one example of this, right? And they're a pretty dire example. But, you know, again, like if you're wondering why you should care, I'll give you the off-sited example. Is the impact of wolves in Yellowstone, right? So they were hunted to near extinction in 1930 by ranchers. And without them, the elk and the deer population that they preyed upon thrived, and their grazing decimated like the streamside willows and aspens, which provided habitats for songbirds. and the stream banks were incredibly susceptible to erosion without the trees, which led to a decline in songbirds, which allowed mosquitoes and other pests that bring illness to multiply. So you see like this very quick chain that happens in the 1930s, which absolutely, you know, decimates entire ecosystems as well as impacts humans. When the wolves were reintroduced to the park in 1995, plant life returned to the stream banks. The birds came back, the beavers came back, the fish came back, the insect populations dropped very quickly. So you can really see the impact it has. If you don't care about the wolves and the songbirds, like what do they do for us? Consider the honeybee. Unless you've been living under a rock.
That has to make, yeah.
Yep. You know about the issues here. So bees pollinate over 250,000 species of plants, including most of the 87 crops that humans rely on for food. So the vast majority of what we rely on for food relies on honeybees, almonds, apples, cucumbers, right? Basic things. But of course, in recent years, huge populations of honeybees have been wiped out by what they call colony collapse disorder. It's probably in response to numerous stressors. I don't think they've nailed down exactly what it is yet. And then, of course, livelihoods are destroyed. So according to a study for the UN, the continued loss of species could cost the world 18% of global economic output by 2050. So these are all my arguments for people who say they don't care if something goes extinct because things change and like we should be more concerned about humans. Well,
right.
If you're concerned about humans, you should be concerned about everything.
The earth adapts. And it's like, yeah, it does adapt. We may not be here for it to adapt. It's adapting, it will certainly adapt.
One of those adaptations may be getting rid of us.
Right? It's like we've been stable because everything else has been the same for a long time.
So with the bee populations, using that example, the collapse of the bee populations has hurt already many. And it's a $50 billion a year global honey industry. So that has already been like massively impacted. Atlantic cod is another good example. So off the coast of Newfoundland, right there, this has been the basis of like the fishing economy since the 15th century. Overfishing has like destroyed the life of local fishermen. So there you go. Just all my reasons that you should absolutely care about this and why the Salties are like a really good mascot for this, because number one, they are in dire straits. And number two, they are so unique. And number three, they are so cute. So there's actually a prominent theory right now that we are in what is called by scientists the sixth mass extinction that Earth has ever seen. So a mass extinction is a very short period of geological time in which a high percentage of biodiversity gets wiped out. And in this definition, it's important to note that in geological time, a short period can span thousands or even millions of years. The planet has experienced five previous mass extinctions. The last one occurred 65.5 million years ago, probably the most famous. It's the one that wiped out all the dinosaurs. That was, of course, the result of an asteroid impact. But experts now believe we're in the midst of a sixth mass extinction. But this time, we're the asteroid. Right? Like there's nothing coming in externally that's doing this. We are doing this as humans, right? With the burning of fossil fuels, et cetera. So if you are wondering what you can do about it, I am aware that I've gone down a path again that sounds pretty fatalistic and dire.
But
so if you're wondering,
real.
Yeah, like, okay, is there anything I can do about it? Absolutely. The biggest things you can do to help are eat less meat. It's the biggest thing we can all do. Buy paper products certified by the Forest Stewardship Council. On any paper product you buy, toilet paper, tissue, et cetera, paper towels, you can look for a stamp on the back. That means they're harvesting from sustainable forests. Things are being replanted. And I'll post a list of more things you can do on our website. So that is my story, how our Salties took us down this path of talking about a much bigger and I think very important issue about the potential mass extinction that we are in the midst of. So Mark, hopefully yours will be cheerier.
Yeah, mine is a little drier, but I think in combination with yours, you've given, you know, a call to action and passionate and an important thing to be aware of. I think mine is a little bit more book heavy because it led me to remind myself of things from earth science and way back when to be like, I've forgotten XYZ about this. So yeah, I'll go in there. It will be different. For a second, because you focused on the Salties, I do think I mentioned them, but in a slightly different way. So at first I thought, oh, maybe we looked at the same information, but it's a little bit different.
Okay, take us away.
Okay, excellent. So as always, I would like to start off with a little trivia to shake it up. So which of the following is not a characteristic of the American harvest mouse? Nocturnal, omnivorous, arboreal, solitary, or arboreal? What? So right, nocturnal, okay. Yeah. Omnivorous, arboreal,
solitary.
Solitary. It's arboreal.
Okay, I was going to say arboreal because I didn't read of any that lived in trees, but then everyone I read about, because I did read about a bunch of the different species until I settled on the salties, I thought they were all like social and lived in burrows. Okay, interesting. Oh, I learned something. I'm sure you're right, because then I went down this deep thing. Interesting. All right.
Yeah, it's the American harvest mouse is a small, nocturnal, and omnivorous rodent that lives on the ground and is solitary. Oh, it does say or lives in small family groups, so not large social systems, but solitary and like maybe a few others, but not totally alone.
Got it.
All right. No, that makes sense. Okay. Yes, a little stroll down etymology lane here, as always. So let's start with our little friend, the mouse. This word has deep roots in various languages. I sort of assumed it would. I figured when we think of something like this that's been around us, certainly in our environment since the very beginning, probably of our evolution, like that it's probably really deeply rooted. And it is. We have it in so many languages in slightly different variations. So I listed them out here. So those languages that pronounce it roughly like moose, rhyming with goose, right? So Old English was moose, M-U-S. Old Frisian was moose. Old Saxon, Old High German was moose. Middle High German, Old Icelandic, Swedish, Danish, Sanskrit, Ancient Greek, Classic Latin, all moose, which I think is kind of amazing.
That's amazing that you found that too, because that's where I got confused, because I read some things that said it like came from the Sanskrit, but then other things said it didn't come from the Sanskrit. It's a thoroughly Indo-European word. And then I just went,
I think it's so ancient that because you have it in at least that pronunciation everywhere, I'm not sure that anybody really knows. I think it's like way back. At least I didn't find it. So then a few more that are interesting, you know, very similar, but slightly different. Pronounced moys, rhyming with boys, is Dutch, M-U-I-S, moys, and then pronounced more like miesh, M-E-E-S-H phonetically. So miesh would be Old Slavonic or Church Slavonic, Russian, M-Y-S. Well, that's probably not the actual names in me calling it what their symbols are.
Cyrillic.
And then one pronounced roughly like Moukoun, that is Armenian, M-O-W-K-N. Hopefully I'm not butchering that, but in the phonetics, it's supposed to be ow as in, oh no, sorry, low. So Moukoun. The O-W is in low, as in low. So Moukoun. And then the last one is most likely where English borrowed it from. We are partly a Germanic language. So mouse, M-A-U-S. In German is mouse like house, the way we say it. Okay, so then, interesting, Allison, you go ahead. You were going to say
something. I just wanted to add one little thing, only for them with the etymology part, though.
I go into the etymology a bit like you did of the scientific name.
Oh, okay, good. Ahead. Then, so one of the things when I was reading about the etymology that I found adorable is that in Latin, right, so many of the Latins, it's moose, they didn't differentiate really between rats and mice. They didn't have different words for them. So they called rats moose maximus, and they called mice moose minimus.
Oh.
And I just think it's the cutest thing. And I was hoping that you would do like an AI generated like Roman emperor mouse named moose minimus.
Yeah, we can do that. Let's do that for Instagram.
For our cover art.
Sure. Or the cover art. Nice. Excellent. Okay, so let's journey a little bit into the scientific name, Rhythrodontimus, which is the genus. And as Allison got into, a little bit of this will be rehashed. It's our grooved tooth New World harvest mouse. So the term marries two Greek words, rhythros, meaning groove, and odontos, symbolizing tooth. Don't even get me started on the D-O-N-T, dentos for teeth. You have dental, you have dent is the French word for teeth. So obviously it all branches out. Rythros, groove, and odontos symbolizing tooth. So as you might have guessed, the name speaks very distinctive grooves that are adorning the teeth of the mice. Also, as Allison said, the grooves are more than just aesthetic. They're essential for the mouse's survival. So they play a crucial role in grinding and crushing seeds, and which is a significant part of their diet. But the grooves also allow these mice to break down the tough seed shells, which is why it kind of grants them access into it for the nutrient-rich, you know, parts of the seeds. Another benefit of these grooves, and beyond nutrition, they also come in handy when it's time for that upward mobility that we've talked about. You know, Allison mentioned, right, the cute pictures of them like in flowers or on like on stalks of grass or something. The mice are expert climbers and they build their nests actually in tall grasses. The grooves in the teeth provide extra friction. So it helps these creatures actually grip grass. So not just the prehensile tail that Allison mentioned as well, but the teeth themselves are actually helping them grip and stay secure as they ascend. Which I thought was really cute. These little things are like gripping, using their teeth even. It's kind of awesome. There's even more to the little unique grooves, though. Recent studies suggest that the grooves might have a social function. Male harvest mice with larger grooves in their teeth seem to have better luck in the dating game, hinting that the grooves could be a signal of fitness and dominance. So the jocks have more of a groove. Look at my groove teeth, baby.
That is hilarious.
Right? Makes me a little nauseous, but also there you go. That's just nature.
I also can't stop giggling at how smitten we are with these things. Like you, I know. You were talking about it.
I keep hunching over anyone who's listening and can't see me. I'm like, you're so tiny. Okay. So a summary about this, right? The groove teeth are a defining feature, aids in their survival and their success in the wild overall. From nourishing themselves to climbing and to showing off and getting mates. I just, as always, like to do the etymology, but not just of mouse, but to actually dive, especially for something like this, which the scientific name, as we know, is always much more descriptive and particularly chosen to reflect aspects of its physiology usually. So that was cool. Okay, trivia number two, as we move along here. Which of the following is not a common name for the American harvest mouse?
Cutie patootie, little baby boy. Think of all the things I'd be calling them. Go ahead.
Plains harvest mouse, eastern harvest mouse, mm-hmm. western harvest mouse, mm-hmm. prairie deer mouse.
I mean, I have to go with prairie deer mouse.
Correct.
Okay, because exactly. I knew all the other ones.
You're like, that's different. Yep. The American harvest mouse is also known as the Plains harvest mouse, the others, but not as the prairie deer mouse at all. There are deer mice, but it's a slightly related but different animal. Okay, so part two, at the risk of being a little dry, but I promise it will certainly round out our understanding of the American harvest mouse. I got into taxonomy.
People are just on the edge of their seats. I know they're with that sell pitch.
After, right, after etymology, Mark's going to get drier. What? We're going to get into taxonomy and the fascinating world of taxonomy. So this is the first episode where we have, and Allison mentioned it because we're using our new noun generator and we got a very specific animal that both she and I went into, you know, the scientific name and everything. So it's the first time that we got an animal as our noun. And this immediately got me thinking about where the American harvest mouse sits in the categorization of all organisms on Earth, right? Boom. I was like, well, I want to picture where it is in the whole grand scheme of things. But more, it made me realize that I sort of need a refresher on taxonomy itself. It's been a very long time since Earth science class for me. Okay. So what is it? Taxonomy is the science of naming, describing, classifying organisms, and it includes all plants, animals, and microorganisms of the world. It is a scheme of classification, especially hierarchical classification, in which things are organized into groups or types. So first, I'm going to give us the full taxonomy of the American harvest mouse. And then I'm going to take a quick, closer look at what this is telling us as we go through it. So hopefully it's not going to be, you know, I'm not going to talk about every animal on earth. Allison's probably already gripping, being like, how long are we going here, Mark?
No, I love it. I love taxonomy.
But I figured this would give us a breakdown at every level why our American little harvest mouse falls into the categories that it does. So I'm going to go from top to bottom. Kingdom, Animalia, or animals. Phylum, Chordata, or chordates. The class is Mammalia, mammals. The order is Rodentia, rodents. The family is, and pardon me while I look at my phonetic spelling, Cricetidae, which is New World mice and rats. The subfamily is Neotomina, which is the American harvest mice and wood rats. And then we get to the genus, which we've already talked about, Rhythrodontimus. And then if we go to species, as Allison mentioned, the American harvest mouse covers like 20 more species. So in fact, I think I might have found something that was like in the 30s. Maybe they're finding new ones or whatever. There's so many that, of course, I'm not going to go into species because there are several. But wait, there's more. Taxonomy, which I did not know, because it was improved in 1990. And I had to think back, when was I in earth science class? And I want to say it was, you know what? It was probably like 90, 91, to be honest. But if it was improved at that moment, I'm sure it wasn't hitting the textbooks in New York State anytime like that fast. So taxonomy was improved in 1990. So that it was an update to include domains. And Allison may know this already. I'm not sure. But no, I was
taking those like bio classes in middle school and whatever in the late 80s or mid 80s. So yeah, I clearly missed this.
Yeah, no. And even as I just went through, if anyone noticed, if you might be in the age range of Allison and I said family and then subfamily, and I didn't even realize there were subfamilies. So I grew up in a time period where you learn different mnemonic devices. Mine was King PC orders famous genie soup. Sorry, I'll never forget it. So that kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, right? And I don't know, it stuck with me as it is intended to forever. King PC orders famous genie soup. And that's kept it. But now there's domains at the top and there's subfamilies. I'd have to think of a whole new thing. There's another famous one. I don't know if you know it, Allison, but I can't remember.
I knew a different one, but it did not stick with me, unlike you. So.
Okay, so domains. There is a three-domain system, a brainchild of Carl Woese and Otto Candler and Mark Wheelis, three scientists who introduced it back in 1990. So what was their aim? They wanted to classify cellular life forms into three distinct domains that they felt like the previous taxonomy structure didn't really cover. So bacteria, archaea, and eukarya. And I will go briefly into what these are. I promise not too much information. Too late, Allison says. Just kidding. Based on key differences.
I'm just kidding. Right, I love this.
So bacteria, archaea, and eukarya. Based on key differences in ribosomal RNA sequences. Anybody? Ribosomal RNA has made a big splash in the world with COVID and vaccination technology that was used. So RNA sequences, cellular membrane, lipid structures, and antibiotic sensitivity. So you might wonder, what on earth is this ribosomal RNA? If you think of RNA as one of the key performers on the cellular stage, right, it's found in cells and it plays a pivotal role in protein synthesis, making proteins, right, acting as a scaffold, more or less, to assist in the formation of bonds between different molecules as the proteins are being built. So picture this, you're trying to sort and classify a collection of organisms. You would look for some common trait. Right. So they went this deep into it. In this case, we're looking at what's called a 16S rRNA gene. This gene is relatively conserved among organisms with both, you know, conserved and variable regions within it. So basically, it becomes a key that you can use to sort of differentiate. So by amplifying the gene through a process that's called PCR, we can compare its sequence with a database of known sequences. And the similarities in these sequences then can reveal evolutionary relationships and help us group organisms into these three domains. So they basically unlocked a way to be a bit more specific, right, than just kingdoms basically being, I think, just animals and plants, and I'm missing one. There's another one. It'll come back to me.
Oh, fungi, animals, plants, I think bacteria, fungus? And fungi, right?
Yeah.
Microorganisms.
Okay, so what are these domains? Let's break it down really briefly. Bacteria, I think we're going to know this, but tiny single-celled organisms, omnipresent in environments ranging from soil and water within our bodies, microscopic entities void of a nucleus. They exhibit an array of shapes, et cetera, et cetera. Archaea. So just like bacteria, these guys are tiny and they lack a nucleus. However, their distinct genetic and biochemical characteristics allow them to thrive in extreme environments. So you might have heard news around these living in like deep sea vents around like lava and like just wildly high temperatures, et cetera. But despite their hardiness, they can also live comfortably in everyday habitats like soil, and even the human gut has some. Yay! Just tell how thrilled. Actually, I'm sure you are geeking out on this.
I am, because so much of our, you know, our makeup is not us.
Right. Like, totally. Right.
I forget what the percentage is, but it's incredibly high how much of our bodies are actually made up of other organisms, mostly bacteria.
Totally. Okay. And then lastly, we have the eukarya, a group including multicellular complex life forms like animals, plants, fungi, et cetera, and protists. And they are characterized by the presence of a true nucleus and other membrane-bound structures within the cells, adding an extra layer of complexities, right? So we are part of that group, obviously. Okay, so now I'm going to zoom in on the American harvest mouse and traverse the taxonomic. Oh, I really went to town writing this. And traverse the taxonomic levels to understand the unique traits that make up its identity. So let's kick off with Animalia. Animals, such as the harvest mouse, are made up of eukaryotic cells. Yay, we have a new vocabulary. We now understand what that is. And are multicellular in nature. They are heterotrophic, meaning they obtain their nutrients from external sources and can move around freely. They have sensory organs. And unlike plants, they lack cell walls. And that totally hit me as I was like, oh, yeah. Like, I can see my desk in earth science class, to be honest, probably. And I was like, oh, gosh. Like, I can see, you know, you have flashes of like old textbooks and things like that. I can literally probably see a diagram of like, this is a plant cell wall and animals don't have that. They reproduce sexually with both complex nervous systems to boot. Okay, moving down a level. We enter into our American harvest mouse's next level, chordata, for chordates. They possess what's called a notochord, or a flexible rod-like structure running along the body's length that provides support. They also have a dorsal nerve cord, which develops into the central nervous system, right? And I always thought that it was all about the spine and that, like, the nerve cord. But they also have a pharyngeal slits or clefts, which is interesting. And not to mention, they boast post-anal tail and a closed circulatory system. So chordates, that, right, that the length of that isn't just the spine and like the nervous system, but also the tail related there as well. Okay, then moving down a level into the class, Mammalia, which comes from the Latin word mama, signifying breast. I think we're probably at this level getting into more popular science types of things where we understand mammals and breast milk, et cetera. Mammals like our harvest mouse have hair or fur, are warm-blooded, have mammary glands for producing milk for their young. They also have a muscular diaphragm, three middle ear bones, and specialized teeth. I feel like I knew that, the middle ear part, which I know is so pivotal for balance. Mm-hmm. And so it's not hearing so much. It's like balance and something else, regulating our senses. But I didn't realize that was a defining feature of mammals, which I think is pretty cool.
Isn't it also that mammals give live birth? Except for platypuses,
that I don't have here, but
I'm pretty sure it is, because reptiles are eggs. I just remember that from middle school, but nobody quote me on that.
No, that's quite possible. The last thing I had here was specialized teeth, which I think certainly comes to the fore with our little grooved teeth buddy, who's not only using it to crush seeds, but to play Indiana Jones on.
I mean, to attract the ladies. Grass.
I mean, and that, hello, look at my grooves. ending the exhibit, advanced cognitive abilities thanks to their complex brains. So complex that they can eventually be so egotistical as to destroy the planet and make up excuses with their cognitive abilities. Teehee. Yay, yeah. The end of the world. Just kidding. Kind of. Now, down to the order Rodentia, derived from the Latin verb rodere, meaning to gnaw. Rodents have a pair. It's just constant etymology. I can never resist it to gnaw. But if you're ever wondering where rodents come from, rodents have a pair of continuously growing incisors. That freaks me out. They never stop growing. Used for gnawing and chewing. They may have cheek pouches. Cute. For storing food and exhibit adaptations for digging and burrowing. Many are active during the night or at dawn or dusk. Crepuscular. Love that word. Rodents are known for their high reproductive rates and diverse habitats, and they play a significant role in their ecosystem. Republicans, you won't swear on our podcast. I mean, I guess I can. Anyway, moving down taxonomy as we continue on to the family of rodents called Cricetidae. So this combines Greek and Latin roots. And it's a fun mix. It's a fun mix. I don't know. It's like I'm selling a car. Of Krikos, the Greek word for ring, and Cricetus, the Latin term for hamster, which I think is hilarious.
Like Latin ring hamster? Term
for hamster. Ring hamster. Who knows? So these creatures, although commonly known as hamsters, are more than meets the eye, ranging from small to medium in size. The Cricetidae family hosts an array of body types, though most members share a rounded body shape with short legs and a stubby tail, which makes them cute to us, right? Immediately.
I mean, honestly, I'm making that cute face again. Also, I have another idea. Like, ring hamster is making me think like there's this fellowship that's trying of rodents that's trying to get a ring to Mordor, and like one's a hamster and one's a harvest mouse, and I'm gonna need you to make that too.
Done. Better take notes. Got a list. Okay, so their diets are as varied as their sizes. Some Cricetidae members primarily feast on plant material, designating themselves as herbivores, while others enjoy more diverse menu, including plant matter, seeds, insects, and even other small organisms, which of course makes them omnivores. So where do these little critters live? They're remarkable architects. Many Cricetidae rodents excel at burrowing, nesting, creating intricate systems for shelter, safety, and raising their offspring. Perhaps
would
even
you call
making
that construction,
nests.
Mark?
Yes, I certainly would. More advanced than just piling things together. Oh. Especially, right, our American harvest mouse, what I didn't dig into, what I would love to see how they build their little nests in the sky, basically, from their perspective, right, like above ground and in grasses. It's kind of crazy. So one feature that truly sets this family apart is their prominent and expandable cheek pouches, perfect for storing and carrying food, as I mentioned. Now, if you're a night owl, you might catch these little guys kind of in action. Most of the Cricetidae are nocturnal. What else? So they don't believe in family planning. Haha. They boast those really high reproductive rates, actually, as we mentioned. Okay. So a little bit, you mentioned now something like the New World. So despite being commonly known as New World rodents, their habitats are pretty diverse. You can find Cricetidae members in grasslands, forests, wetlands, as we talked about, and even, agricultural areas. So the New World is simply a term used to distinguish them from Old World rodents, which is of a different family, Muridae. Muridae? Yeah. Muridae. So very related, but I think they just use that in the taxonomy to say the others from other parts of the world. So while Cricetidae call the Americas their home, Muridae rodents are usually found in Europe, Asia, and Africa. Which is it's bringing like Fievel vibes to me now to be like,
absolutely.
Right? Like the new world of the whole thing.
I was actually looking up to see like, are there any either movie, animated movies or children's books where the mouse character was specifically a harvest mouse, right? Was Stuart Little a harvest mouse or was he a field mouse or was he a deer mouse, right? But I couldn't find much.
Right, exactly. He certainly wasn't the little white skater mouse from the 90s film or whatever that pissed me off. Anyway, I'm just cranky old man now to get it older. Like I had the very specific book with the great, beautiful yep. illustrations mm-hmm. that you can see. He had his little hat and he was very thin and oh gosh. Anyway, so let's delve deeper into Crichetidae today and meet the subfamily Neotomidae, derived from the Greek word term for newer. Neotomidae includes over 300 species, mainly small rodents, and they're distinct for their cranial characteristics, and they inhabit a variety of habitats from deserts to forests to grasslands. Interestingly, some are pests while others contribute significantly to scientific research. I wouldn't say any of them are, you know, it's probably being a little harsh, but the scientific research part, I'll get into a little bit more soon. So moving further down, coming to the end here, to the taxonomy ladder, we land at the genus that we've talked about, Rhithrodontimus, that we discussed. And I won't go any further than that, as I mentioned, because there's more than 20 of the species level. Okay, trivia number three, our final trivia for my rabbit hole. Which of the following is the smallest species of harvest mouse? Is it Western harvest mouse, salt marsh harvest mouse, fulvous harvest mouse, or plains harvest mouse?
Salt marsh harvest mouse.
Yes, exactly. Right. It's like a softball question.
I was well prepared for that one.
The salt marsh harvest mouse, as Alison mentioned, Rhithrodontimus raviventris, is the smallest species of harvest mouse, as you already said. I wonder, does our data compare 2.5 to 3.5 inches in length?
Oh, I had 2.2 to 2.8, but yeah, that's basically.
Great. Okay, very final mention in my last part here. So that's putting taxonomy aside. Everyone, give you a second to heave a deep sigh of relief. But I mean, I was joking aside, I loved doing that because I really, it refreshed, you know, what I consider one of one of the most foundational classification systems that we have to understand
absolutely
animals in the world around us. So the American harvest mouse is a seemingly modest creature, but it's significantly contributed to various scientific fields. It's proven to be a remarkable resource for understanding genetic diversity, speciation, environmental adaptability, and disease dynamics. Listen up, GOP. So beginning with, not just the salt marsh, but the whole species, all 20 some odd. So beginning with genetics, the American harvest mouse serves as an excellent specimen for studying diversity and speciation, right? Delving into its genetic makeup, researchers have deciphered population structure, traced evolutionary relationships, and even documented the creation of new species within the genus Rhithrodontimus. So I think it's always exciting when we can find and really identify new species altogether. This exploration provides fascinating lens into intricate workings of evolution itself. I have to pause and hopefully the chances he would ever hear this are so nil, but I had a trainer like 15 years ago or something. Good guy, you know, but a trainer, a little bit tiny, not to, you know, pigeonhole, but a little bit of a meathead. And at one point, I think he just was brought up in a very Midwest sort of like limited education place. And when I don't know how we were talking about evolution while he was training me, but I mentioned evolution and he was like, well, yeah, but they've totally disproven that. Right. And he like legitimately thought it was disproven. And I think I like dropped my weights. I was like, I'm sorry. No, no, it is. Evolution is still going strong, bud. What?
Wow.
Anyway. So the fact that, you know, my last sentence there was an intricate lens into the workings of evolution itself. Yes, yes, it is.
Brought back some traumatic memories.
Seriously, what? Okay, so next we turn our attention to the mouse's adaptability to various environments. I love that Allison mentioned drinking salt saltwater, you said, for the salt marsh in particular. But just in general, I think they've been studied to see how they adapt, which sadly will probably be relevant for more and more species as we either try to save them or we try to adapt ourselves. So this adaptive view, So ranging from, you know, where they live, grasslands, wetlands, to forests, and the adaptability is demonstrated in a study titled Effects of Natural and Anthropogenic Change on Habitat Use and Movement of Endangered Salt Marsh Harvest Mice. So there you go with the salties. I knew it was mentioned somewhere in a slightly different way by Smith and colleagues. So the research explored how male salt marsh harvest mice seek refuge during high tides, during high tide events, and how human-induced environmental changes influence the mouse's behavior. So the findings underscored the importance of healthy intertidal vegetation for biodiversity conservation, intricate, you know, I'm sure this study was probably used in the justification for everything that you're just talking about, right? Is your cat losing his mind?
I'm so sorry. I was not watching. My cat was in my lap and he just sneezed about 12 times in a row.
Oh, I thought he was shaking his tail. That's so cute.
I mean, he was, but then he was like sneezing 12 times. I don't know. Maybe he's getting all excited by all this talk about mice.
Right. He just hears it. I want the salties. That's really.
Gosh, if anyone could hear that, I'm so sorry.
I barely heard it myself. That's really funny.
Okay. So sorry. Go ahead.
No, of course. I think the probably some this research I would think was used partly as the justification for the bill you were talking about. I don't know that for sure, but talking about how important they are to, you know, to support the vegetation, the biodiversity of the area, et cetera, et cetera. So, however, the study also highlighted the need for more comprehensive research, including females, the young, subadults, et cetera. They just focused on males for some reason. Don't know why.
Because they got those groovy teeth.
Right, exactly. So then moving into the field of comparative genomics, I just love how the American harvest mouse shows up in these like major pillars of science. So comparative genomics, the harvest mouse has gained some prominence. Researchers, by comparing its genetic makeup with other rodent species, have identified similarities, differences, and traced the evolutionary pattern. So these insights help unravel sort of broader evolutionary history of rodents and shed light on the genetic basis of a lot of those rodent traits, which I think is great. Anything we can shine a light on and understand more, all about it. So lastly, they also play a critical role in disease research, acting as a natural host for certain pathogens, including hantaviruses. Mm-hmm. So this interaction has expanded our understanding of zoonotic diseases in general and their transmission dynamics between animals and humans. So, you know, can't get more relevant than that, frankly, lately, unfortunately. For sure. And with climate change, that those types of jumps are expected to become more frequent.
Yeah.
As an environmental indicator, changes in the populations of American harvest mice overall can reflect broader implications for environmental transformations, including habitat loss and fragmentation. And finally, in reproductive and behavioral studies, the mice's prolific breeding capabilities, short lifespan, and adaptability can make them ideal for investigating influences on reproduction and behavior, perhaps behavior like flaunting their large grooved teeth if they have them. All right. In conclusion, that these humble little guys and girls and gals underscore the grand lessons we can learn from even the smallest creatures, which is partly why my Just the Hits today was about this. Even the smallest creature can change the course of history. They provide invaluable insights into genetics, environmental adaptations, as I mentioned, diseases, etc. And that is my mouse burrow hole something for this week.
I loved it. I loved the refresher on taxonomy. Absolutely. And you said tiny creatures again. It just reminded me about All Creatures Great and Small, which is a series of books by James Herriot, who was a British veterinarian, rural, you know, farm veterinarian, back in the earlier part of the 20th century. And PBS has done an amazing series on it from the 80s when I grew up, but it's been rebooted in the past several years and you can watch it on your PBS channel. And it is delightful.
Oh,
it is
amazing.
So well done, and I highly recommend it. So actually I'll make
it. I've never seen it. I'll have to check it out.
Mark, it is truly delightful. All right. Well, this was great because honestly, I can tell that both of us have become totally smitten by these little critters, like all the research right. and all the pictures. And like I said, I'll put some links to some of the most adorable pictures you've ever seen of mice up there.
Yay.
But, okay. Here's my big question. I already know what Mark's take is going to be, but I still think it needs to be asked. So tying in also with my whole, we're talking specifically about an animal here and then tying in with my whole extinction theme. So there are people, a very large, you know, number of people in this world who believe humans are, you know, the kings of the earth, that we are ordained by God to rule over the animals, right? It says something like this in the Bible. And there are people who believe, look, we, you know, animals are here for us to eat, for us to utilize. And if things go extinct, that's fine. We've already talked about why it's not fine. If you want to broaden your thinking, but I, of course, don't see it this way. I don't think that, you know, we are that much more superior, but can an argument be made that we are in fact superior to the other animals because we have consciousness, which is always what's listed as setting us apart. Right. So,
I mean, other animals have degrees of consciousness.
Thank you. I totally agree. Okay, done. Check.
That was right. Like, I think it's all a spectrum. They're not perhaps as, well, now I'm curious, as conscious. Yeah, no, I think that's fair. But yeah, but no way. I mean, we talked about wait, I'm going to say it wrong because you corrected me once. Octopuses, not octopuses.
You got it. Yeah, octopuses. That's correct.
Got it. Yes. And how wildly smart they are. Dolphins, of course, everybody holds them up. Everybody knows their deal. But yes. No, I certainly disagree. If anything, I feel like we, being the most conscious, the most, I will say we're the most cognitively gifted. Or unless we find out that we're the most gifted of a combination of cognition and the ability to act on it in a certain way, like perhaps we're going to find that like octopuses wildly smart, but can't, I don't know what your cat's going to do.
It's so funny. I'm watching him over my shoulder, like about to pounce. It's
He's
really
never in frame that much. We talked about mice for the last hour and he is
everywhere. Yeah, we're talking about consciousness and animals understanding, right. Well apparently his English has gotten very good.
He breaks the whole thing and finally speaks. It's like, oh, we can talk the whole time. Yeah, obviously you called it. I agree that we are not, and there's a whole host of reasons why. To also say that we are like the absolute best, well, how are we defining that we're the best? Even you saw me just struggling with, was it a combination of we can think and then act on it in certain ways, but I'm sure you could look at certain animals that do certain things much better than we do, right. That are more gifted in a lot of other ways. That being said, I do think we have a responsibility as being certainly the dominant species, dominant in terms of our, gosh, what do I want to say? Our power, our ability to have impact and clout. Right. Like we can certainly.
Well, almost like stewardship. Like I feel like we have this responsibility because of our level of cognitive ability and opposable thumbs to be a steward of the earth and the animals versus dominate them and use them to our will. So yeah, I think you and I totally agree. And you mentioned octopuses. I mean, they've done study after study on how conscious they probably are. And to your point, we're just defining it one way. We don't understand enough to understand, right? Like how they view the world and how they view themselves. But there are enough studies with them that we know that they have a sense of self-consciousness, which is fascinating. And they're still doing studies on dogs and dolphins and all of that to test the same thing. So I guess then the flip side of my question is, at this point, like, do we just deserve to go extinct as a species? Because we're doing it to ourselves.
Something about it, and I'm not sure what it is, that deserves trips me up, because then it feels like there's some level of logic or judgment hanging above it that can make sense of deserves versus not. And I don't think that exists, but I do feel like maybe it's not deserves. I wonder if because evolution is evolution, what am I trying to say? It's like, if you look at this, if you look at the system of species surviving over time, right? And you just look at it as massive, almost like this color-coded thing. Certain species have, we say the term, we had a good run. They have a good run because they had a combination of specific physiological traits and a level of cognition or a level of something that suited them to have a good run and then fade out. Perhaps our Achilles heel is what we kind of talked about, the way that we don't take on stewardship, the way that we don't equalize with our environment. It's like the cue, the Matrix, and the famous line from Agent Smith being like, you are a virus, right? You just consume and leave waste behind. It's like, does that make sense? Like
it makes complete sense.
And
yeah,
so I like, don't know that we deserve it, but I think it might just be in our nature to, I mean, that's the talk about not to trying to be fatalistic. Ourselves. Yeah. It's just, we're not going to have the right combination of like communal thinking or empathy for our environment to not put instant gratification and certain needs first without thinking of the bigger picture, I guess.
Right. Just like a level of hubris that would be evolutionary.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, because we're programmed to survive in a certain time period, 1.2, when did we start? Really 70,000 was cognition, but as a species, 1.2 million, 2.3 million.
I mean,
but anyway,
yeah, I don't know.
We covered it in one of our previous episodes.
We absolutely did. And that sounds right, but I'm not going to say it. As a species,
2.3 million, but like as our modern cognition, as I couldn't even say it, modern cognition, I want to say was 70,000 years ago. Anyway, yes. Clearly, I have a lot to say about it. I'll shut up.
Well, oh, sorry. The cat's back. This is just honestly fascinating. So, all right, Mark, hit me with your big question.
Hit me with your best shot. Okay, so big questions. Are animals like the American harvest mouse? Sorry. Are animals like the American harvest mouse a way in to more emotionally resonant storytelling and activism to address climate change? It's funny that you and I just talked about the cuteness, thinking back at like characters and films, et cetera, et cetera. Mark Rylance was quoted, Mark Rylance being, I don't know, Allison just clutched herself, one of our absolute favorite.
I put my hand on my heart, to be clear. Mark's made it sound dirty.
No. Clutched your chest.
Referrals.
Mark Rylance was quoted in 2021 saying, "We are not lacking information about what we need to do to help the climate crisis. We also really need the arts to remind us how, we are part of the same family as the nature that surrounds us," right? He's advocating for emotionally centered stories and artistic experiences to make people care or to incite change. My mind just, and it didn't when I was writing this, jumps to Watership Down. And now that is a very broad, it's an allegory for different types of societies and living and left versus right. There's a lot going on in there. But one of the things it starts with is sort of the bulldozing of their original habitat, which kind of can think of the impact on the habitats of a lot of the species we've been talking about today, et cetera. Anyway, so to incite change, he really thinks that artists have this responsibility to create and to incite that sort of change. And it seems to be such a prevalent truth around the human condition, right? At least to me, that logic has less power over our habits and actions than emotions. And, why is that? Talk about our, that might be another reason why we're faulted in some ways. So that was really my big question is, when Mark Rylance says something like that, and it makes me think we spent the week talking about this cute little mouse and it became for us just doing our research, if you agree, Allison, like this adorable little thing that then reflects such broad climate and environmental impacts and damage that's being done. For me, it reminds me of, could an animal like this be a way into that type of emotional, big social bell that needs to go off?
Yeah, I think the answer is absolutely. I think, first of all, Mark Rylance said it, so of course it's true.
Hello. And, yeah.
Also, it's been known for decades now in the charity world, not specifically related to animals necessarily, but also, you know, to animal welfare charities, but to all charities. If you want to garner more donations, if you talk about famine and you talk about a population undergoing famine, you're going to, you know, maybe garner X amount of donations. If you tell the story about one child who's going through it and show pictures of that child, your donations go up exponentially. And they're doing exactly what you're talking about, Mark.
That makes sense.
They're playing on our emotions and our ability to relate to that one child or that one, you know, stray dog versus wrapping our heads around, oh, okay, thousands of people are dying from starvation. It's easier to stay distant from that if you don't personalize it. So yeah, I think absolutely the arts are important. And I think artists are important in this space as well as just emotional storytelling. And I think that's probably why I went down the path of the salties, because I did a lot of reading on a bunch of species, but this was what resonated with me. Right. And that's exactly why, because they're these cute little mascots for a broader issue, and what's happening to them is horrible, but it also signifies larger things. So I think that the more we can tie the fatalistic stories we tell in with something like that, the more people can relate to it. If I'm telling you a story about when I was looking for examples, for instance, other examples of extinction and why they matter, like the wolves, wolves are big, scary predators, but people also tend to like them and be impressed and in awe of them. But I could have told you a story about these condors and these vultures in India, but they're hideous and people just wouldn't they wouldn't feel the same amount of resonance, even though the impact on the ecosystem and on especially disease in humans is probably even bigger. So yeah, I'm with Mark Rylance on this one.
Makes sense.
All right. Well, shall we review our ratings on this one?
Yeah, I was just looking. And I think we both were at 8s.
Oh, interesting. We had the same thing. That's right. I had forgotten that. Yeah. So I'm going to stick with an 8, actually.
Me too.
It was so different than what we're used to, but I learned so much about specifically the salties, but also just this whole genus in general that I didn't know. And I got to look at a lot of cute pictures. So yeah, thumbs up for the American Harvest Mouse.
Yeah, I'm going to be boring and do exactly the same thing. Yeah, I thought it was good. I went into it thinking it would be interesting, and it was. Great.
Excellent. All right. Well, let's generate our noun for next episode. This is the first time I'm using it, so I'm very excited. Mark's amazing new noun generator. So here we go. Oh, I wonder actually, and I was thinking this when I was thinking this after the fact with American Harvest Mouse, did we not want to have proper nouns, which American Harvest Mouse is. But anyway, because the word is Somali.
Oh.
So, I mean, I'm happy to go with it, but I just realized, did we ever clarify if we would...
I don't think we did.
...do proper nouns or not? Then let's do it. All right. Somali, yes. S-O-M-A-L-I.
Cool. No, I if you agree, I think this is great because...
Yeah.
Still noun, proper noun, and I think it's going to bring.
I think it'll be really
interesting. It couldn't be more of a perfect thing to bring more awareness for me, especially. I know you've done a lot of work.
Yeah, but not in Somalia.
But in that vein of kind of exposing yourselves to other countries and
other
and
cultures
like that. Yeah.
I'm going to go with an 8 again, because I think that there is just so much to learn here.
Yeah. I'm going to go with a 6.
Okay.
Excellent. Oh yeah. And everyone, as Allison mentioned, if you wanted to check it out, it's a new, fairly new feature on our website on renownpodcast.com. So you'll see a tab for the noun generator. We're hoping you're following us today, episode to episode, but certainly you can generate your own and go down your own little rabbit hole of research.
Exactly. Play with your friends at home. Right. All right. Well, thank you everyone for tuning in. As always, if you enjoyed the show, we would love it if you would follow us or subscribe on whatever platform you use to listen to or view your podcasts. And if you have time to leave us a rating, it really helps us continue to create the show and helps other people find the show as well. You can visit us on the web at renownedpodcast.com or on social media at renownedpodcast. And we hope you'll tune in for the next episode with our new noun, Somali. Thanks, Mark.
Bye, everyone.